My name is Mary Ide. I'm director of the archives at WGBH in Boston. And today we're talking about Big Bird's digital future. In December 2000, Congress appropriated funds for the National Digital Strategy effort to be led by the Library of Congress. The vision of the National Digital Information Infrastructure Preservation Project, affectionately known as NDIP, is to ensure access over time to a rich body of digital content. To this end, NDIP has established a national network of committed partners to construct a digital preservation network. Included in this network is digital television. Over the last 40 years, American public television has been producing programming that reflects and documents our social, cultural, and political life, and in and of itself is a record of U.S. non-commercial television. The NDIP Public Television Project is a collaborative effort spearheaded by Channel 13 in New York City, working with WGBH in Boston, PBS, and NYU as partners. As public television has moved into the digital production process, these records are increasingly at risk of loss due to equipment and format obsolescence, the lack of a system-wide preservation mandate, and the scarcity of preservation funding, not unusual. The major focus of the Public Television NDIP project is to plan for the long-term preservation repository for born digital public television programs. Part and parcel of this plan includes reviewing best practices and current developments in the field of moving image archives management. Now, one key component is developing appraisal and selection criteria, outlining what is to be preserved, why, who will do this, and how, thus endangering that we keep Big Bird off the digital endangered species list. In her new book, Archival Appraisal, Theory and Practice, Barbara Craig says, no one tool on its own constitutes a complete foundation or a framework for appraisal and acquisition. Our panelists today will present at least two appraisal frameworks for the selection and preservation of public television master programs and production elements. The first outlines the framework from a collecting institution, and the following two perspectives are from the viewpoint of a public television station that is producing programming. This is like multitasking. Our first speaker is Tom Connors. Tom is a senior curator of the Broadcasting Archives at the University of Maryland, with primary responsibility for the National Public Broadcasting Archives. Before moving to Maryland in 1993, Tom worked as an archives consultant to the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. He has also worked at the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations, the University of Vermont, and Yale University. Tom is the adjunct professor at the University of Maryland's College of Information Studies, where he teaches a course in visual and sound materials. Tom will be followed by Lisa Carter. Lisa Carter is currently the Director of Archives at the University of Kentucky Libraries Special Collections and Digital Programs. Previously, she was UK's audiovisual archivist and a film cataloger for the American Archives of Factual Film at Iowa State University. In 2002-03, Lisa worked with Kentucky Educational Television to establish an archival program, and digitize their video archive. Her most recent article, Saving Our Legacy, Archiving Television at the Crossroads, appeared in TV Quarterly, Winter 2000. And finally, our last speaker is Lisa Wisey. Leah has been an archivist at the WGBH Media Archives and Library since 1997. Her primary responsibility is in both the field of records management and advising on the accessioning of new material into the archives. Leah has been on committees that developed the current digital asset management system at WGBH and has been working on the NDIP project since 2004. And Leah is the one person on the program that is directly working on NDIP, and Lisa is advising. Leah has been co-author of several articles on moving image archives management that have appeared in the Moving Image and in Building a National Strategy for Digital Preservation, Issues in Digital Media Archiving. Prior to coming to WGBH, Leah worked as the project archivist for the Thomas P. O'Neill papers at Boston College and as the corporate archivist for the Kohler Company in Kohler, Wisconsin. So while we're still somewhat in our technology challenge, we could start with Tom first.
Thank you, Mary. Some of the people who came in a little bit more recently, there is a handout that maybe you haven't seen. It should be back in the corner table there. And if there's not enough, if you could buddy up with somebody and read together. And if you want the handout, just give me your card at the end, and I can make a new set. I made 75. You know, I think there are more than 75 people here. I'm going to talk about sort of outline the lay of the land in terms of appraisal of broadcast program from the point of view of a collecting repository. We have here people connected more closely to stations themselves. I'm in an organization that works with public broadcasting, but is not a public broadcasting organization. Is this better? Yeah, that's better. Okay. But I'd like to begin. Well, when I talk about appraisal, I'm mainly talking about what Mary Ide and Leah Weissey have termed preservation appraisal, as distinct from acquisition appraisal. I will come back to this distinction in a little bit. I'd like to begin, though, with a digression of sorts. And that digression is the notion of universal access to all knowledge, as proposed by Brewster Kahle. Brewster Kahle, as you probably know, is the founder of the Internet Archive. Universal access to all information argument, universal access to all knowledge, I should say, implies...
Evening, Doc.
Yes, indeed. We will...
implies, or more than implies, that selection for reformatting is no longer necessary given the advances in digital storage technologies. Now, back in the winter of 2004-2005, the Library of Congress ran a series of panel discussions that were aired on C-SPAN. And these were called Digital Futures, I think it was called. And they would have various experts that would be seen every week talking about what their take on the whole matter was. And Brewster Kahle happened to be one of these people. And the format was that the panel, you know, the guru, the expert, would speak, and then there would be a commentary by other people. And they were often Derek de Kirchhoff, who's with the Library of Congress Kluge Center, brilliant man, and Bob Martin, who at the time was director of the IMLS. And when Brewster Kahle spoke, he got into this whole thing of universal access to all knowledge. And on the handout, in the handout, I have two cartoons on the front, which I'm going to sort of end on that point. So you can just read them and enjoy the humor. But the second page of the handout has to do with Brewster Kahle's universal access to all knowledge. And you can go to this website. You can get to it through C-SPAN, but I tried and couldn't. I think you have to have some kind of password. But if you go to this IT Conversations website, you can actually hear his whole hour-plus-long discussion of universal access to all knowledge. And really, he talks about, you know, this is a very important thing to do, and it's possible now to get everything digitized, everything in the world digitized. And when he talks about it, he talks about it like in four. He asks four questions. Should we embark on a program to make all knowledge available to all humans at any time via digital technologies? Can we do this? Is the technology possible? May we do this in terms of, you know, do we have the sort of some sort of societal permission to do this? And will we do this? And he answers yes to the first three: should we, can we, may we. But he says he cannot answer, will we, because that's a large decision. It's political, it's all politicized, et cetera. So when Brewster was finished, Bob Martin commented very politely that his remarks were indeed thought-provoking, and then he talked about the wisdom of digitizing everything, saying that librarians use the notion of selection and archivists use the notion of appraisal to help them choose what should be preserved for the long term. They believe that not everything needs to be preserved, nor should everything be preserved. And when I was watching this at home in the evening, it was about 6:30, 7 o'clock, when Bob used the term appraisal, I said, whoa! And my wife was upstairs. She said, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I said, Bob Martin just used the word appraisal, artful appraisal on television. First time probably ever. C-SPAN, but it's television. To my recollection, Brewster Kahle never really responded to Bob's observation. But Bob's rebuttal struck a chord with me because my own dean of libraries at the University of Maryland had made a point similar to Brewster's when I was talking to him about going for a sabbatical to take time to do more study into the issues of selection. And Dean Lowry said, that's really not that important anymore. So so much for the sabbatical. But I'm not convinced that selection for reformatting is no longer an issue, and I say this on two grounds, mainly the sheer volume of what's out there in terms of broadcast materials. Now, so there might be some repository that just has the wherewithal to digitize everything across the board. But that's not the case hardly anywhere. So just the sheer volume, there's got to be a piecemeal approach, and this means selection. And two, it has to do, of course, with value. Is everything worth digitizing? And that gets into a whole other question. So let me turn a little bit quickly to terminology, especially to the distinction between acquisition appraisal and preservation appraisal. In a recent work on appraisal by Frank Bowles, Frank says that he takes issue with the term appraisal, saying that he likes selection better, that appraisal has more to do with fine arts. And so throughout the book, he talks more about selection. Jerry Hamm, in his SAA manual, also talks in terms of selection. He says archival selection is composed of various activities, acquisition, accession, and appraisal. And one of the bedrock articulations of archival appraisal is made in Richford's 1977 basic manual on appraisal and appraisal and accessioning. And in that, he kind of equates the terms. So I think that simply as a practical matter, we got to talk about appraisal because that's what we've been doing for so long. And I think the first time I've gone back to look at when the word appraisal was first used in the American Archivist, and I went back to the 30s. There was a little item about appraisal, archival appraisal. So it's so much part of our parlance. I think we have to not take issue with it as Frank has done. Now let me move to acquisition appraisal and preservation appraisal. In the article that Leah and Mary published in the EMEA Journal, Developing Preservation Appraisal Criteria for a Public Broadcasting Station, they draw a distinction between acquisition appraisal and preservation appraisal. Acquisition appraisal criteria are what guide you in choosing AV materials for transfer to archives, whereas preservation appraisal criteria are what guide you in what will be reformatted and in what order and for long-term maintenance. Go much more into positing this, and I think it's a very useful distinction to make, and I think it's the first time I've seen that distinction. And in fact, the article that I had on this issue that was in the American Archivist in 2000, one of the readers of that article, the peer reviewers, took issue with what I was saying that I wasn't talking about appraisal, but I was talking about selection for reformatting, and that's a different thing. And I think that Mary and Leah's use of this has been very helpful. There's not a lot of literature on appraisal of audiovisual materials. The next sheet talks about some archival appraisal criteria for non-print materials in some key articles. One is from Norman Charbonneau of the Library and Archives of Quebec, Scylla Ballard and Rodney Teagle from Australia. I don't know what their institution is. Chris Payton from the Georgia Archives, and Dave Baldwin from, I think he's from Baltimore. I won't go into all of this because it just take too long, but the handout shows you the kinds of thinking that people have in terms of dealing with non-print materials, because they talk about photographs. Norman Charbonneau talks about photographs, as does Teagle and Ballard. And so, but these are really mostly dealing with the issues of acquisition appraisal. And the literature having to do with preservation appraisal is even less visible. I'm going to talk about at least what I've written about and what Mary and Leah has written about, not to steal your thunder, but I'm just going to just outline it. In 1995, Mary, how long do I have now? Where am I?
Time-wise. 95.
Time. Oh, how much time? You have 10 minutes. 10 minutes, I'm good. Okay, good. In 1995, Mary and I got a Bentley Library Fellowship to look into this issue of reformatting. We were calling it, appraisal criteria for public broadcasting materials. I was taking the viewpoint of a collecting repository that has a lot of this stuff, and Mary was coming at it from the viewpoint of a station that produces a lot of this stuff. And we came up with appraisal models for this. The next handout is my particular take on it. We're looking at Frank Bowles' work and looking at Schellenberg's work and looking at a bunch of other things having to do with production of public broadcasting material programming. And the use of public broadcasting programming, reuse, et cetera, came up with these. The idea was to be able to look at the material I had that I was bringing into the public broadcasting archives, and then decide the kind of prioritization that was required to get these things transferred. So I came up with the considerations, provenance, cost of retention, implications of the selection decision, reference potential, and critical values. And what this kind of gives you is, if you can apply this to sets of programming, you come up with a pretty interesting picture of what is significant and what is maybe less significant. I've not been able to really apply this in a massive way, and I've gone to I've looked into getting some grant funding to do this, and without success as of yet. But we do have a kind of an interest at the University of Maryland to test this out a little bit more. On the flip side of that handout, there's a ranking system that was developed by my student, Daniel Demura, on how to, so it just is sort of a supplementary thing. My approach was more interpretive and comparative, and Danielle's brought some numbers into the mix, and that's kind of an interesting thing there. The next handout is just the database, kind of the fields that we use when we try to apply this. But as you can see, it's time-consuming. So we've done maybe of a particular collection of video, PBS videos that we have. Maybe we have 4,000 individual tapes, 2,000 tapes representing about 400 programs. We've only really applied this to about 50 of these, and so it's not. It's very interesting what you get when you do apply this, but it's very time-consuming to do it. In Mary and Leah's article, Developing Preservation Appraisal Criteria for a Public Broadcasting Station, they came up with four essential values, institutional values, informational values, reuse values, and then cost of retention considerations. I recommend that article very highly. I use it in the class that I teach, and it's a very useful thing because it's coming from real world. It's not sort of sitting back in Ann Arbor thinking this stuff and in the bar after we're at the library. So, and I know I only have a couple of minutes left, but the issue of selection, as it has been considered by people involved in digitization projects, mainly library-based, may also inform the issue of selection of audiovisual materials for reformatting. And so the next couple of handouts deal with this. The Library of Congress's Selection Criteria for Preservation Digital Reformatting, and Janet Gertz's selection guidelines for preservation. Janet is the director of preservation at Columbia and has been involved in this for a long time. I think this is more useful. This is fairly useful, I think, for applying this to audiovisual materials. Just to end it quickly, just go to the cartoons on the front page. This is where this wife is saying, and of course the husband's there just reading the newspaper, completely oblivious to the fact that he's got a guest. When radio came out, we waited for plug-in sets. When plug-in sets came out, we waited for the super heterodyne. When they came out, we waited for FM. Then he decided to wait for television. Now he's decided to wait for color television. And he's sitting next to a wonderful wind-up Victrola. And this has to do with, you know, just the mechanicity of all of this. And this is a kind of basic consideration, what really drives appraisal of this kind of material as opposed to appraisal of traditional material. The other cartoon says, all we want is a nutty situation comedy. The door you see says educational television. And all we want is a nutty situation comedy with a catchy title and into which we could subtly inject our course in nuclear physics. Sounds like Monty Python to me. But this is about content. This is about, you know, knowing about content, being able to interpret and understand content very quickly, and also understanding some of the technological issues. So that's sort of where I leave this. I just wanted to give you a sort of a lay of the land kind of thing and talk about some of the ways I've been thinking about this. But the last item is on the last page, and it's a quote from Marcel Duchamp. And of course, Marcel Duchamp was a sometimes surrealist, a sometimes Dadaist, I suppose. He was started out as a painter, a post-impressionist painter. He quit art in order to play chess for the rest of his life, and he was great for his ready-mades. One of them having been a urinal that he kind of flipped upside down and tried to get it into an exhibit, a large exhibit, calling it a fountain. It was thrown out, of course. But the way Duchamp thought about it, he said, the great problem was the act of selection. I had to pick an object, this is his ready-mades, without the least intervention of any idea or suggestion of aesthetic pleasure. It was necessary to reduce my personal taste to zero. It is very difficult to select an object that has absolutely no interest for us, not only on the day we pick it, but that will never, and that finally can never have the possibility of becoming beautiful, pretty, agreeable, or ugly. And I thought, you know, the approach I've been taking is fairly rational, trying to understand things in an interpretive and evaluative way. Maybe the answer is really irrational, finally. So that's the lay of the land. And if people did not get one of these, and if you want this, please give me your card.
Okay, well, now Tom's given you kind of an overview of appraisal as it applies to television materials, specifically public television materials. And I'm here to assure you that the situation in public television stations is dire. Archiving activity of any sort is poor to non-existent. So the current state of television archiving, whether you're in a public television station or not, it's a little bit better in public television, is that appraisal is not really done. It's not done at any stage, whether preservation or at the acquisition stage. Description. Information is the descriptive information that's available is primarily what's on the tape label. They don't keep up a database of their assets. Or if they do, the databases are numerous and inconsistent, so each producer might have their own database, or this department has one database and the other department has another database. They store these old 3/4-inch beta, 1-inch tapes wherever they can find space. And that might be in offices or in a hot warehouse or in the basement under some water pipes or in what used to be a dark room. And even if they try to reformat to migrate the content forward, there's no standard format that's recommended for them to use, so they're not doing preservation reformatting. Also, any archiving activity is based on an analog workflow, which relies pretty much on tapes on a shelf, playing the tape to find out what's on it, and thinking about discrete physical objects and thinking linearly. So instead of thinking digitally, they're still thinking analog, which is all kind of straightforward, straight ahead kind of thinking. This means that stations are not managing their assets in any useful way, not for them and not for the archivists who will follow them and who will eventually inherit these cultural objects. This leaves the television stations unprepared for the digital future and leaves us with a mess. Tapes are deteriorating on the shelves, often unplayable, when we get them 20 to 30 years after creation. And worse, we don't even know the gems that are on them because these tapes haven't been described. All of this results in an accumulation of tapes. And this is the accumulation of tapes at one television station. And I have several photographs like this of other television stations as well. But as you can see, they're stored in offices, just sitting here on the desk. That's the bottom one, in boxes on file cabinets, and then in numerical order as they aired on some shelves in the back room. And I don't have any pictures here of the tapes that are being kept in the dark room. So this is the situation that most public televisions face. Stations are now driven by this accumulation of tapes to do something. Faced with space and access concerns, they're starting to make selection decisions based on space and format. Can they play it back, for example? And the information that they have on the tape label. So in some cases where it just says, carry 10-21-02, that's the kind of decision they've got to make. Do I keep this based on that information? I don't know. Stations are highly frustrated, and people tend to discard lots of material based on poorly defined criteria. Past purges are a reminder of the folly of this approach, and we think back to the mid-'80s when they were moving from film to videotape, and they would just load the 16-millimeter film out into the loading dock and into the dumpster, and our archivists would come chasing after the dump truck. But they're facing issues without any reasonable conclusions or solutions to their concerns. How can they decide what to keep and what to spend their limited resources on? It's not enough to tell them to focus on their mission and their anticipated needs to select the materials. That often comes naturally to us as archivists, but they don't think that way. They kind of need some guidance and a tool. So stations need this big picture work done for them. Archivists need to move from the available literature, which Tom has laid out and Mary and Lee have contributed to providing a boilerplate set of criteria that can be used and localized by the stations. Then there needs to be a useful free tool that can be used to do appraisal and descriptive work. A sample worksheet might even be just the trick to give stations a tool to get started. We'll stay on that one for a while. The set of selection criteria and any tools must be developed with the station's goals in mind. Any impetus for change in a station's workflow or practice must be relevant and easily show how archiving correctly benefits their bottom line. Appraisal must be promoted as a way to meet the station's desire to reuse footage, to cut down on the cost of reshooting, to generate revenue as other stations use their footage, to deliver programming on the web, to address the lifelong learning needs of their communities, and to reconnect with their audience. Stations see archiving as a way to save money and space. We need to appeal to their mission statements by pointing out that appraisal helps them make responsible decisions about what assets to keep. In other words, addressing their need and their mission statement to be good stewards. And that some materials need to be kept for the public good, even if they can't see a current use for them. By making good decisions about what to keep, they will enhance the public trust, and they will be more responsive to users' needs and requests. The appraisal of the backlog in public television stations is both appraisal for acquisition and preservation, in that the two are integrally intertwined. Without the activity of appraisal, this material does not truly become part of their archive, and then it also can't be preserved. So without appraisal, it's just another old tape on the shelf. In the digital world, appraisal is a matter of survival. Appraisal, formal or not, happens during the production process. Footage is ingested, manipulated, changed, kept, or discarded based on individual producers' own judgments as to whether or not it has use for current production or for later production. Files get trashed or overwritten with hardly a thought. There's no longer a physical object to encourage wanton keeping. The creator is also responsible for effective labeling, and in an environment where things have to be described by file name or in the metadata to be effectively retrieved, institutional memory and spatial acumen no longer cut it. In this way, the role of the creator is crucial. It is complicated by the fact that many people are involved in a program's creation. So consistency, implementation of standards like PBCore, and archival input are necessary throughout the production process. The key is harnessing the current selective and descriptive activity For example, the production's aesthetic judgments and the edit decision lists, and showing them how it must change in the digital environment to enhance their work and the preservation of objects. The digital environment might even assist in forcing standardization through the use of pull-down lists and save and move on protocols, like you can't do what you want to do until you fill out all these fields, which is sometimes the only way to get people to fill out forms. In addition to harnessing aspects of the production process that might impact appraisal, key to the survival of any footage is an effective shutdown procedure that encourages production staff to turn over their files, tapes, and objects to the archives. There are inherent trust and expediency issues involved in setting up such a process, especially when most television stations don't have an archive. What they might have is a clerical person sitting in the back room who's in charge of the tapes. But shutdown is the opportunity to apply truly standardized appraisal criteria and metadata standards. This shutdown procedure is really the only place to apply administrative metadata that can automate some aspects of rights management when something is moved to deep storage, when it needs to be refreshed, or when it can be discarded. So the effective appraisal of digital broadcast materials is ultimately linked to the quality of the object's metadata. Use of a standard such as PB-Core provides a structure and guidelines for what kind of metadata should be gathered and how. More tricky is actually getting it done. We have to get creators and producers to document the information only they know, especially in terms of rights and value. The gathering of this information can be made easier if we can provide automated tools, systems that suck in the information they are already producing, like EDLs and shot lists, avoid creating an extra step. Automated tools can control how data is entered through things like drop-down lists, alerts before they can move on. Finally, systems can track and alert on the use of information critical, on use information that's critical to appraisal, such as recording how often an object is used, its context in regards to the other objects, expiration of rights, checking for vitality of the digital files, and things like that, of that nature. Then the data, input first by producers, regulated and enhanced through systems, should be run through a shutdown procedure that allows an archivist to enhance the metadata and select for long-term storage. So why should archivists care, especially archivists who don't work in public television stations or aren't audiovisual archivists in universities or wherever these things are being stored? Well, we're the experts. We are the professionals trained to apply selection criteria. We have the fundamental understanding of information creation, which allows us to advise on a more efficient workflow. We understand what needs to happen at the shutdown point of a production. These materials document the sights and sounds of our time, and they represent our world and activities in ways that newspapers, letters, email, and even photos don't. So we really need to think about saving our history that is kept on these materials. We will also eventually end up with this stuff anyway. Again, what will happen, as it's happened so often in the past, is we'll be called up by a television station as the tapes are on the loading dock ready to go in the dumpster. Oh, by the way, we're going to throw out our stuff. Do you happen to want it? And then we have to race to get there before the dump truck does. And besides, our users kind of expect us to have this material and or that it was saved. Quite often the archives is the place where people call first, and if we can't tell them that we have it, then they expect us to tell them who does have it, you know, that KET still has it or Wave Television still has it. So it's crucial to keep in mind that our users really don't care what form the information comes in. Whether it's a moving image, sound materials, or whether it's a newspaper, they just want information about the topic that they're interested in. And it's crucial to provide a complete picture that we save these materials. So I would encourage us all to think that this is relevant to the work we do. I'd like to leave you with a sense of why local television should be of importance to all of us. Our local television stations act as portals through which Americans come to understand current events, shape their political opinions, develop their sense of culture, and measure their quality of life. People's aspirations are both reflected and influenced by the television they watch. A well-rounded representation of our natural culture and attitudes depends on the documentation of our regional stories. Our local programming joins with local programming from all over the country to make up our national identity. We need to ensure the preservation and access to the digital material these stations are keeping to keep the documentation of our national experience real, diverse, and relevant. And so I hope you all go back and think of how you can work with your local television stations to make sure our modern history is being preserved and selected appropriately to bring us back to the topic. And then Leah's going to talk a little bit about how one television station is implementing some appraisal criteria. So I'll turn it over to Leah.
Somebody could actually probably draw a good cartoon about this.
Yeah, I was, this is the difference between the PC and the Mac world. And you thought we were all united. Okay.
Actually, this reminds me of the Mac PC commercials that are currently on television, Ryan. I envision the two guys basically taking each other by the throat and going, no! That's sort of what we're doing here.
All right, so I'm Leah Wisey. I work at the WGBH Media Library and Archives, and this is the on-air, the what we do and how we do it, a step-by-step introduction to not radio and public television production, but archiving, or an insider's look behind the scenes at WGBH. The Media Library and Archives at WGBH is responsible for all aspects of logging, tracking, and organizing of stock footage, originally shot footage, and stills. We negotiate discounts with stock footage houses to provide our productions with deals on stock footage they can buy elsewhere. And part of our department also sells originally shot footage that WGBH has shot to other productions. Even Hollywood movies have come and used our stuff. We currently house more than 10,000 boxes of material and more than 50,000 audio, video, film masters. We have over 500,000 items in our database, and it's growing. We actually have a fiscal year that starts in September. Since September, we've brought in over 27,000 items. Over 4,000 items were accessioned in July alone. We circulate our material to our productions, and we've circulated over 11,000 items, 886 in July alone. So we're busy. Our productions look at us as not just an archives, but a library of material and moving image, audio, and still that they can reuse in the productions. So here's the future. This is actually from our website, Portraits of Tomorrow. And the caption here says, operations that once were manual and time-consuming, such as typing logs, loading and unloading tapes, will be fully digital and largely automated. Radio and TV programs, web content, and print documents will reside in a large central content depot nearby to be accessed as digital files that are easy to move and share. This is an artist's concept of the master control room in our new building we will be moving into in the next 4 to 6 months. Now, I don't know about you, but I live AD, analog digital. We still have the open reel 1 and 2 inch videotapes, and we have digital files. So what do? You can use our digital asset management solution, which we do have a digital asset management system at WGBH, but most of our productions are still tape-oriented. So we spend most of our time on MARS, the Media Archive Research System. This is a database that's available to everyone in the foundation, and a lot of what I'm going to talk about is metadata, because this is the database that points back to the tapes, and in a digital world, it would be the database that would point back to your moving image file or audio file that people would then download and want to use. So when I'm talking about databases, I'm actually talking about the fact that we have the content creators create information, metadata, and databases that come into us. And our production shutdown compliance team reviews these databases, grooms them, cleans up the information, gets the language standardized, and moves them into the larger database. Since September, we've looked at over 578 databases. And the production team is basically a production shutdown manager that deals with compliance issues and contacts the productions. Two archivists, myself and a coworker, who groom all those databases, add additional metadata for administrative purposes to the catalog records, and a special projects assistant who helps out with our database issues. This is the accessioning timeline. This is a very, very broad outline of the production process with points at which the archives interacts with the production team. I'm going to go over this very fast. I have my email address at the end. You are welcome to email me and get this electronically and any of the templates that I show. At pre-production, which is the startup phase, the archives contacts the production team. At this time, the production has pretty much been outlined. They've decided what they're going to film, who they're going to interview, and where they're going to film. The production manager, or compliance manager, sends them a production shutdown notebook. The notebook explains what items will be required as deliverables at the end of the production and provides them database templates with instructions on tracking newly shot or original footage, stock footage, and still images that are used in the production. And then we begin with the shooting. When shooting begins, which is that next little phase down in the bottom there, the archives assists the production teams with entering information into the database templates. During this phase, footage is shot and logged, appearance releases are signed by on-camera participants, and interview transcripts are created. And just about every single one of these items we want to come into the archives. But we need to be able to track them, we need to be able to find them again, and that's where we're relying on the productions. It should be noted that the production team at this time is creating the moving images as well as the descriptive logs to those images. With the archives' assistance and advice, the production team is using the database templates to capture metadata, descriptive, technical, and administrative. This is an example of an original footage entry. You can see there are pointer here isn't working. There are places for the tape number, the camera roll number, the subject, the date it was shot, and if there is a transcript made available. There's a great big white space at the bottom, shot by shot, time in, time out, every second on that tape, we want to know what's on it. There's a similar one for stock footage. Again, it's a lot of information, tape number, source where they got it from, what's on that tape, what information does it cover, and again, a place to put shot by shot, time in, time out, what exactly is on that tape. Capturing this information early will be increasingly important in a digital world. Right now, they're shooting onto a tape, and then that physical tape can come to the archives. But there are cameras that record onto hard drives or V-chips. These are very expensive, and so productions have a tendency that when they want to go that route, they're going to film, they're going to download those files to a server, they're going to film over and reuse that chip or that hard drive. And if you don't have something like this, or especially this information to capture it, you won't know what you've got. Because it's been my experience, people are very idiosyncratic in what they name their files. We're next going to talk about the whole middle section, the rough cut, fine cut, picture lock, online, and mixed sections of the production process. This is known as editing or post-production. It's during this phase that all the bits and pieces, the stock footage, the original footage, the music, the voiceover, graphics and animation are all put together into the final broadcast program. Through phone, email, and in-person visits, the archives maintains contact with the production team throughout this phase. It's at this phase that they begin to fill in the materials used entry. This is a database of what shot is actually going in the final program. And it will tell you things like what the source tape was, what exactly is in that shot, and as you notice on the bottom, it's giving us rights information. We cleared this shot to use it only in the U.S. market or worldwide, or it can be streamed on the internet, and for how long. By the end of the online and audio mix sessions, the archives will have received a final materials use database that lists every shot, both original and third party, in the program, along with its related licensing. This is an example, and it's a little hard to see, from our MARS database. We took all those three different databases that the production sent us, and it exists in our large database. This is a cue sheet of a final program, Victory in the Pacific, an American Experience program. And it's listing every shot, it's listing where it came from, the source, and it's listing how much they paid for it, what rights they needed to clear, etc. The reason this is all blank up there, these are public domain images, so there was no information to put in. This is another cue sheet from an American Experience show, Fidel Castro. I brought this up because in the first couple of places, it looks blank. The first shot is actually a piece of an interview that the production team for this public production actually shot themselves, so they didn't have to pay themselves in their own license or anything. WGB owns it. The second shot in sort of the blue, the source there is WGBH itself. So, of course, we're not going to pay ourselves to license ourselves our own footage. This is an example of where the Fidel Castro production team actually used footage from a 1992 Frontline program called The Last Communist. So this is an example of how they are reusing originally shot footage from one program and series to another. And how could they find it? Because we made them fill out the metadata and import it into our database. The final on the bottom, it's hard to see because it's in blue, is actually listing a shot that they got from the NBC archives, and that is why all that information about U.S., worldwide, whatever, is filled in, and they cleared it for in perpetuity. So NBC said, yeah, you can use that whenever, wherever, we don't care. Now we're going to talk about the end of the production process, where it says deliver program materials to the archives. We provide templates to get the physical material in, but also we provide, this is basically a one-page, here's what you need to send us. It lists what we want sent to the archives department. That first listing are basically all master-level tapes, original footage tapes, stock footage tapes. It's all the media we want. It also lists all the documentation we want, whether print or electronic files, what needs to go to budget, what needs to go to legal, because we don't take everything in. But legal needs to track some of this. Budget does. Interactive does. And again, feel free at the end to send me an email in a few weeks. This is basically embedded into this template. This is the template to actually send us the physical tape. I see a lot of information. This is from a Frontline show called The Storm. It's original footage on DV cam, shot September 25th, 2005, tape 52A. It's in 16:9 aspect ratio. It's an interview of a man named Max Mayfield. On the bottom is the administrative information we need to put in, like physically where we're tracking the tape. All of this stuff comes in, links are made, and it's all imported into the repository for possible reuse as selling as stock footage to another company or for another production at GBH to reuse. This is an example of the program record in MARS. Again, this is the record for The Storm. It gives you series title, program title, date of broadcast, brief description about what the program is. And on the bottom is where we're linking and listing all the assets, all the tapes, all the files, everything associated with that program. I'm showing you the list of all the different master level tapes. And I know it's hard to read, but there are 13 different master level tapes that are considered master level for this program. That's 13 tapes that are the final broadcast version. And that's exactly what I mean, version. We could have this program in 4:9, 16:9, letterboxed, anamorphic, a pledge version, a stunted, shortened version. They may have the version where they, and I didn't put that in on my PowerPoint, where it actually said we left the mother Ecker in versus out. The reason I showed you the Fidel Castro, given what's going on in the news right now, they made back in 2005 an alternate ending in case Castro died before they clicked the program to air, and I have a feeling that might be airing soon. So In addition to all the tapes, the footage, the scripts, the final broadcast, you have all the ancillary elements, such as online press kits, companion books, board games, teacher's guides, study guides. There may be footage that exists only for the website. There are instances where only on the website will you get that interview with the producer or the director, or there may be a behind-the-scenes of or a making-of segment on the home video or DVD that only appears on the DVD. Those are actually not produced by the production team. They are produced by many different departments within WGBH, and bringing those assets into the archives has been a little less methodical than what's been generated by the production team. Finally, I'm going to talk about a little story about a series we did in 1959 called Press and the People, an Inquiry into the Work of the American Press. This is actually, now I'm going to start getting more into digital. We found this, a coworker of mine did, while inventorying film. This is black and white 16 millimeter film negative, a kinescope. It basically set a film camera up next to the TV camera and filmed the show. We discovered this while doing an inventory, bringing the film from off-site back to on-site, and it was something really valuable, especially since there was an interview in there. The host was a man named Louis Lyons, a noted broadcast journalist and curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard for about 30 years, and he's interviewing Edward R. Murrow on the responsibilities of television. So he took the film, reformatted it, to digital beta, made a beta SP analog also version, and a VHS viewing copy. That has since been digitized into our digital asset management system. When we digitize into this, we use Final Cut Pro through an AGA I/O box. It's digitized into DVC Pro 50, and at the time it's brought into the system automatically creates a high resolution essence file, and it creates at the same time a low-resolution proxy digital file that's put into a QuickTime wrapper. The file size depends on the length of the tape. Typically, 20 minutes of B-roll from a digital beta will take up about 8 gigabytes for its essence. Now, that may not sound like much, 8 gigabytes, but a high-resolution, hour-long program takes up quite a bit of space on a server. As a matter of fact, we had a program where they had shot in high definition, and we had the high-definition digital beta tapes. We could not digitize all of them into the system because we would have used up all our server space. So from this, you can actually stream the file and watch it or download it onto your desktop.
Peak evening dot.
And get this.
Yes, indeed. We were all impressed with what you said in Chicago, Mr. Murrow, and I'm sure we want to inquire as to how inevitable is this lack that you feel, and which certainly concerns us all. Well, to begin somewhere, what would you say are some of the serious omissions in television coverage of these great facts of our time?
Well, I would think at the outset, Mr. Lyons, that most of the meaningful programming is done in what has come to be called the intellectual ghetto on Sunday afternoons. This is a time when many people find it inconvenient to view television.
When the football game is on.
True. And when the children are at home.
Yes.
I would think, in addition to that, that there is very little done in the area of searching examinations of our foreign policy, very little in the way of a critical examination of the state of education in this country. In short, very little is done to reflect, to use television as a mirror to hold behind the events of the day. And so far as I am concerned, it doesn't matter to me in the least whether what is reflected is a picture of bigotry, of intolerance, of indifference, or great high achievement. The important thing is that the mirror should be there. Yes, sir.
Yes.
I actually went into our digital asset management system, went into the storyboard section, and created that clip, then downloaded it as a QuickTime movie and embedded it into a PowerPoint presentation. My point being that the digital future is all about reuse It's all about metadata. It's all about tracking and finding those moving images, audio, and still images again. So it can be reused for something like that. It can be presented on different venues through webcasting, podcasting, whatever. The shutdown checklist and accessioning timeline that I discussed here was developed AD, analog digital. It is subject to periodic review, but we have found that even as productions move more and more into the digital world, want to become tapeless, and digital formats change, this is still a viable procedural model. The website URL you see up there is the Preserving Public Digital Public Television NDIP website. A fuller paper on appraisal and selection for public television will be posted on there. And the email you see is mine, so that if you want to get electronic versions of that accessioning timeline, shutdown checklist, or samples of the database templates, we're a file maker oriented system, but you could still use it. We're welcome to share it and adapt it for your own purposes. Thank you.
We have time for questions now. Tom, you teach, right?
You have to. Could you repeat the question?
Okay. The first question is: what are there classes?
This is for the tape that is being made. So we have to repeat each of the questions, or else we put our.
The first question is: are there classes on television digital archiving? Tom.
The class that I teach at the University of Maryland is called Visual and Sound Materials, and it's geared towards people in the archives track as well as people in special library. Track we read a little bit about visual literacy, for instance. There's a Beth Kaplan article that has been reprinted a number of times, but where we teach it from the viewpoint of a special library, and so it's more looking at things not from such a technical point of view, but from just a sort of archival procedural point of view. And also we get into the technology, the histories of the technologies, the characteristics of the media, but nothing. I was going to ask Leah, how did she learn this? Was it on the job? This is not what we teach in maybe the UCLA program. If anybody's here, might get into more of that because there's more production possibilities out there. But
maybe the NYU program is more focused on technical aspects. NYU Moving Image Archive Program, Lisa.
And the NYU program is also much more oriented towards television, whereas the UCLA program and the GEH programs they're coming from a very film-based viewpoint, and television really is a different animal, especially when you're having to work with producers. So there really aren't a lot of educational opportunities out there for people who want to be television archivists. The NYU program is probably the closest. The Association of Moving Image Archivists offers a conference every year, and they have workshops, and you're also then in a community of people who are television archivists. As to how Leah or myself have the experience that we have, we did learn it on the job, I would say.
Yes, is this on? Okay. When I first started at WGBH, there was a group in Boston that would offer at a minimal fee classes, and I took a class on video production where we actually, we learned all the ins and outs and had to go and film and edit together a little video. I followed that up with some additional editing classes from this same organization, which is now defunct. I also did what archivists are trained to do, and that is ask questions. So I was asking questions of my coworkers within the archives department of everybody that I came and saw, and to this day I still do. I will pull a production person aside and say, give me an update. Now that you're going digital, what are you creating? Do you still create this item? Do you still bring it to us in this format? And so that's also how we consistently update our shutdown checklist and our timeline procedure.
And I want to underscore that point that she just made, that a lot of the work, especially WGBH's digital asset management system and a lot of the stuff around it, is really a collaborative enterprise between archives and production, and that can be quite a challenge, but it's absolutely necessary to get archiving done in television environments.
Okay, the second question was the lifespan of DVD and VHS formats. Does anybody want to address that? Not long.
Yeah, magnetic media, depending on the format, could possibly maybe last as long as 50 or 60 years, but in the conditions that it's normally kept in most television stations, it's more likely to last 20 to 30 years if you're lucky. We're now losing the 3/4-inch videotapes that were taped in the early 80s, so that's about 30 years, right? There's a lot of documentation online that you can go to find the stuff out. We start out with Van Bogart's 1995 piece on magnetic tape preservation, and then there's a lot of stuff around that. The AMIA website has a videotape preservation handbook or something to that effect that was written by Jim Wheeler and then revised by the Preservation Committee. NIST, I don't actually know what that stands for, National Institute for Standards and Technology or something like that. But they have just recently published a piece on the stability of CDs and DVD media. And Jim Wheeler and Peter Brothers just provided information on an ISO standard for the storage of CDs and DVDs. That should be coming out. If it isn't already come out, it should be coming out soon, I think.
There is also something I use in my class. It's called the Care and Handling of CDs and DVDs, and mm-hmm. it's a manual. I can't remember the author as I'm sitting here struggling to remember.
Is that Clear?
Yeah, I believe
it
so.
Is
yeah,
Clear.
Yeah. So CLIR.
And I would just back up that the more digital recent magnetic media is very, very fragile. We've actually had digital audio tapes, DATs, that have died on us, where actually I had an American experience. They needed the opening music for a single program that had been specially composed. The DAT, there's nothing left on it. They had to go back to the composer, and he sent them a CD. This DAT was only about 2 to 3 years old at the most.
That was good for, when it first came out, a lot of the field people working in the field, the producers or the talent or whatever would enjoy, that capacity to have that stuff, but it was never meant or thought of as any kind of long-term life.
And to answer the last question about teams, I put the slide back up. Our digital asset management system is powered by Teams, which was an Artesia product. Artesia has now been bought by, I've forgotten who. The URL down there is dl.wgbh.org. I believe you can put that in. There's no www in front of it. You can put that in, and it will get you to information about our digital library and digital asset management system.
Okay, question.
And that was the challenge part that I didn't get into. Yes, no, unfortunately...
Could you repeat the question?
Unfortunately, the question was, does the database system that tracks the physical items, MARS, talk to our digital asset management system? And the answer is no. We have to re-enter all the metadata or copy and paste it. And I have been, over the last 9 months to a year, every time I can bring it up, I say, how's that trial going of trying to import the metadata from one system into the other? And there are other issues to deal with, so it kind of gets bumped down on low priority of, well, just copy and paste it, Lee, and enter it all again. And that is unfortunate that the systems don't talk to each other. But as you could see, even with our switching computers, technology and formats, it's all still kind of, we're in a format war right now.
So you're committed to the system?
Right now... Going to different systems has not been raised as an issue. As a matter of fact, the institution is just recommitted to FileMaker and moving on up into the next version. FileMaker finally became a relational, truly relational database and gave us the capability to make it available through a web browser just within the GBH on an intranet kind of a basis. And Teams is also actually you access it through a browser and a URL.
The question was, what kind of outreach is being done to television stations to keep them from chucking their tapes? And actually, what I kind of glossed over in my presentation is that television stations are now coming to us more than we're doing outreach. And this comes down to they're now seeing, they regret what they did in the mid-80s by throwing all their 16-millimeter film out because they realized they could have taken that and made HD quality footage from it. So before they make that mistake again, quite often they're calling up whoever's name they can get a hold of to ask them about archiving. The Association of Moving Image Archivists has created a purple guidebook called Local Television, A Guide to Saving Our Heritage. And that is our kind of intro to the public or to broadcasters to say, you want to save your footage, here's the things you need to think about, here's what you need to do. And it's kind of a really superficial treatment of it, but it does get people interested and gives them some people to call. And we're hoping to get that up on the AMIA website sometime in the near future. So that's one way that outreach is being done. And actually, the NDIP project is, you can Google something like television preservation or digital television preservation, and the NDIP project will come up. So that's another way that outreach is being done. But I would say, in general, archivists aren't actively going out there and talking to their local television stations anymore.
When my program had some money to support such a thing, I did on occasion sort of ad hoc go and visit some station or in a city I happened to be visiting, even for an SAA meeting, like in Denver. I went to KRMA and talked to people there about the importance of this, and again, they were the exact same thing. They had gotten rid of they were coming out to a 50th anniversary and saying, like, gee, we just don't have anything to show about our early programming. Do you have something, Tom? And I said, no, I don't. And it's that kind of thing where I spent a whole morning just trying to explain what could be done here. And I ended up speaking mostly to the volunteers, not to the real people that are doing volunteers are doing great stuff, but the production people were busy. We have some of us who are in public broadcasting archives have talked about getting some kind of conference going, like on PBCore, which is the Dublin Core kind of equivalent of description of public broadcasting programs. And that has actually, taken some, that's really got some traction in public broadcasting itself. So it's not really an academic or somebody coming out and saying you should be doing this. Just this morning when I was at my office out at the University of Maryland, there was a message that had come in yesterday, I guess, while I was here. So somebody from a Houston public television station saying, we'd like to archive some of our footage with you. How do you do that? And then, of course, all the questions come to mind, like, what is it you got? How much is it that you have? And isn't there somebody there that can do it? Can't you do this? And so I will call this person back on Monday to see what that's all about. But it's a word of mouth thing, almost more than anything.
The NDIP initiative is very actively pursuing trying to come up with effective ways for advocacy about this. Nan Rubin is the director of the NDIP Public Television Initiative, and she is here. Nan, did you want to say anything? And just to recap, Nan's pointing out that the NDIP initiative in the next year is looking at how to create and effectively get across to the general public the importance of digital preservation. So I think we will see more of a public awareness, hopefully growing, in this issue. Other questions? Yes.
This is a really relevant question. The question is, can we call preservation done by reformatting digitally? In other words, if we reformat something digitally, is that also going to become obsolete in the future, or
is that a proper preservation mechanism that'll last thousands of years? And the answer would be that digital is not really the solution we're looking for, because it is just like the other formats. It will eventually become obsolete. Television stations ask this question all the time. They think digital is the answer because that's what they've pretty much been told by the people who sell them the equipment, that Digibeta somehow is going to be the format, or HD HD cam is going to be the format, or Motion JPEG 2000 is the format. But what I do when they call me is I encourage them to think, no, it's just another format like all the other formats that have become obsolete in the past. You need to think instead about, especially with digital, a long-term migration program. So invest now in a system that's going to allow you to revisit your material, your data, your formats in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And, you know, by then maybe it's holographic or something else. But the point is to start investing in that now. And then the other thing that I always do when I talk to these folks is tell them you've got to keep the original, because so many of these television stations have thrown out their 2-inch quad videotape, and if they had just kept their 2-inch quad videotape, it would probably still play back today. It might be a little expensive to play it back, but it would still play back today, and they would get a visual image that's so much higher than the 3/4-inch tape that they transferred it to, that they'd be a lot more pleased with the resulting image. So keep the originals as long as you can, and who knows what kind of technology is going to come down the pike to play back that tape that you thought would be unplayable.
Just one comment on that. You know, it's funny, grooved recordings are terrific. I mean, they last a long time. But the Edison thing is funny too, because you couldn't play an Edison disc on an RCA Victrola. It was completely sort of proprietary to Edison's mind. So what we had a project at the Library of American Broadcasting side of my shop, which is the sister collection to the Public Broadcasting Archives, but that documents more broadcasting in general. We had a project going for a while where we had these phonographic recordings from the Radio Advertising Bureau, and they were little clips radio advertisements from the 50s and 60s. Terrific, like beer commercials and cigarette commercials and all these things that now you can't put on the air. But we started to tape them in order not to, you know, apply wear and tear to the phonographic recording. But what did we tape them onto? DAT. This was back in the 90s, and now we're having a little problem there. So we didn't solve the problem we thought we were solving.
Keep the original.
We did what we did, of course, yes.
Additional questions in the back there? So I think in summary, the point was that it's not only preservation, but it's preservation plus services, which increasingly in time with multi-versioning and new versioning becomes complicated. Does anybody?
Rob has a question.
Yeah.
Question two.
Well, this is part of the NDIP initiative that we're looking at. Okay. We're talking about the issue of scalability with digital programming and what's realistic that a local entity could manage. No, but this is one of the components of the NDIP initiative, to come up with both the essence and the wrapper standards, and that we aren't quite there yet. But we're getting now. To go back to your digital tape issue, the PBS broadcast standard is DigiBeta. So at WGBH, that's what we keep as the master program. Does that somewhat address this?
Is that compressed?
Yes, DigiBeta is. But since it's our broadcast standard, you know, that is our master level.
There is a whole section of our NDIP project that are all the technical people, and they're thrashing this question out. And I believe in March there was a large meeting with all the technical people and the Library of Congress to address that very issue, because there are lots of standards out there. Everybody's sort of throwing out, this is what we think. Some of that information is summarized, and that's why I put the URL back up there for our site, because we are sort of posting this information as it comes up and gets threshed out.
It's a complicated issue, and Carl Fleshheimer from the library is here, and I'm sure would be happy to fill us in on MXF and wrapper issues.
One point to mention is that the Harvard, it's the World Music Library, Charlie, is this, and also the Folklore Archive at Indiana through NEH are going through this audio sort of standard, digital standard kind of project now. And they've been at that for a year, and they're going to report in another, 6 months, I believe.
Tomorrow at
4
o'clock.
Well, that's sooner than I thought. Well, let's all go over there. But it's the audio is, you know, is easier, and so that's kind of where our focus
audio,
is.
Audio, video, and the R&D, which is the Harvard Indiana project. There'll be some interesting things to
good
hear
to know.
See.
We probably have time for one more question. Okay. Well, thank you very much.